Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Get Yourself the Job. My name's Allison Garrido and I'm so pleased to be guest hosting today while Jennifer's traveling. I'll be with you this week and next, and I'm so thrilled about the guests we have today. You might remember me because I do some guest hosting when Jennifer travels, and I also join Jennifer pretty regularly for mock interview Mondays. So Jennifer will be back in 2 weeks, and I'm thrilled to be with you today as she is out of town. My guest today is a good friend and a woman that I'm so happy that she's here to share her knowledge with you today. Kelly Watson is managing partner of Orange Grove Consulting, an innovative training and leadership development consultancy focused on helping women and organizations eliminate outdated rules and structures so they can achieve wage and job parity. A seasoned consultant in organizational development, marketing, and operations, Kelly's also the co-author of The Orange Line, a woman's guide to integrating career, family, and life, which was published in May of 2013. I've had the honor of seeing Kelly speak a few times, and I attended her webinar recently, and I was just telling her, I'm always hearing her voice in my head with all these interesting facts and statistics about women in leadership, and I'm just so thrilled that she can share her knowledge with you today. So welcome, Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me. And what a great introduction. I feel very important right now.
You are. You have a lot of great information to share with our listeners. So tell me a little bit about the work that Orange Grove Consulting does.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity. So yes, what we do is we help organizations identify the parts of their pipeline where we have leaks. So we know that women have not achieved the parity in organizational leadership as we have at the bottom of organizations. So we know now that about 53% women graduate from colleges and enter the workforce. So we have, you know, pretty much job parity at the bottom of organizations. But what we're not seeing is that translate at the top. So we're, for example, in tech, it's about 17% of organizations are led by women in tech. And about 24% of board representation. So even in organizations that and industries where millennials have made a lot of progress, we're not seeing that translate to women. We've, I think, had a myth over time that, you know, if we put women in organizations and as we have since the 70s and 80s at the bottom, that it's like a pyramid and that over time they will be promoted and they will get to the top. And so this is just something that we just have to be patient and wait for. And I think a lot of women have felt that our time is coming, that we've made progress, and that that's good enough. But there's some recent data out of McKinsey that shows that we are still over 100 years away from having women in parity at the top because of some of the organizational structures that have prevented women from moving up. And I don't know about you, but I have two daughters, and one of whom wants to literally be a rocket scientist. And that's not good enough for me because that's not them. That's not their children. That's their children's children. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that really strikes, you know, it strikes me at the heart. And I know that a lot of women that we've worked with in organizations feel the same way, that this isn't, it's too much of an uphill battle and it's too far away. So for us, we feel a call to action and an urgency that is more that is more sharp, and we help organizations with that because there's a lot that's there, right? There's, you know, there's everything from, well, we can't find enough women because women don't want to be in tech or they don't want to be in leadership, or there's this myth of the ambition gap with women. And then there's, you know, fears about skills. We still go back to, you know, organizations feeling that, well, maybe we just need to better train skills, that women somehow are, I hate to use this analogy, but special needs children that need to be still trained because we're lacking in somehow in our leadership abilities, or that it's not natural or innate for us. So we have a lot of work to do. And we, when we work with organizations, because there are a lot of organizations that are really tuned into this right now and are really making a massive commitment to getting more women into leadership, we're throwing a lot of, I just want to say, we're throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall to see what's going to stick.
Absolutely.
And that's inefficient, and unfortunately that works well only when money's flowing and times are good. And as soon as times get tough and budgets constrain, because they're not seeing a lot of direct ROI on that, these are the types of things that get cut. So we're also seeing a lot of organizations pay lip service to it. So, you know, they'll do a lot of stuff to check the box, but not necessarily make any impact. So our organization, Orange Grove, we are committed to doing the analysis to find out where in the organization we're falling down. And it may be in a lot of different places. So we have this balanced scorecard approach where we look at a lot of different typical areas where we have structural problems, and then we work with the organization on the right approach to solve those problems so we can make a measurable impact. And that's a big part of our work as well, is doing the measurement.
Interesting. So in the beginning, you talked about a company pipeline, and I thought, geez, I wonder what that means, a company pipeline. I think of maybe a sales pipeline. but I think you touched on that a little bit when you talked about the places in an organization where women maybe either don't get there, or do they jump off, or is there a place where they should. Tell us more about this pipeline and where there are opportunities for us to notice.
Right, exactly.
Well,
so it's the pipeline. When we think about an organizational pipeline, we think about all the different places in an organization where women can either, from the entry point at the beginning to steps along the way that you need to take in order to get to another step. So there isn't always a direct correlation between the job that you enter and getting directly to be CEO or president. There often are a number of experiences that typically you'd want to see an employee get so that they are prepared for the jobs at the top. So it may start that you're an individual contributor in a particular area, or you're on a line job so that you're understanding how a manufacturing process works or whatever. And then, you know, you may want to move yourself into a more financial role so you understand the levers of the organization. So there's generally a pipeline or a traditional sort of a path. And it can be varied and it can be matrixed, but for the most part, there's kind of a way through the organization that's going to give you the experiences you need. And the problem is, when we refer to a leaky pipeline, is when we refer to a situation where you have a lot of people enter, a lot of women or a lot of minorities enter, but for whatever reason, they can't get the experiences they need, so that then when you get to the top, or when you get to the step right below the top, there aren't enough candidates that have the experience you need that have come through the pipeline because they've leaked out in some way.
Ah, very interesting. So you mentioned that there were a great deal of companies that are actually really focused on this now. And so if someone is thinking about, geez, I want to work for a company that's thinking about parity and thinking about women in leadership, are you seeing commonalities between those companies that are seeking out women leaders or seeking out help from people like you who can help them identify the leaks in their pipeline?
Yes, and I think this is something that it's a good time to be a woman who aspires to leadership, because there are these organizations that are looking for you. So the question is, how do you find them, though, and how do you differentiate between an organization that's checking the box and an organization that truly is invested and cares? And, this is probably something that you do a lot in your program, where you work with your candidates on how to interview a company, because I know that we spend a lot of time promoting ourselves and not a lot of time listening and asking the right questions, but it really is important. So a couple of things. First of all, if you walk into an organization, you look around and you don't see a lot of women, and specifically you don't see a lot of women in the roles that you're interested in. So if you look up the chain and you don't see women, that's a pretty good sign. That they're struggling. If you see women, but you see them in stereotypically female jobs, we like to refer to them as pink collar jobs. So we see a lot of women in HR or marketing, but we don't see them in finance or running a P&L somewhere, or in the manufacturing. That's another sign that the organization hasn't necessarily done a good job at putting people in the positions that are going to get them the exposure to lead ultimately. So those are some signs. And then you can ask. You can ask questions about what do you do to help women navigate through the pipeline. Is there a proactive program of mentorship? Or is there a, do you, just even asking the question, do you actively manage your leadership pipeline? Because a lot of organizations think that they have fostered a meritocracy mm-hmm. and that they don't need to actively manage that process, that right. the cream of the cream will naturally rise. And I'll give you an example of why that isn't the case. Well, first of all, if you think you have a meritocracy, you probably don't. It's the organizations that actually recognize that it isn't a natural thing to have a meritocracy that, and are working on it, that are actually probably fostering the best possible meritocracy. Mm-hmm. But and again, privilege is invisible to those who have it, and that's an important thing to understand. But if you think about, so one thing, for example, there's a lot of data that women don't ask for money, right? And they don't ask for promotion. And it starts with, there's some research by Babcock and Levisher that women graduate from college and they go to their first job and they don't negotiate that first salary, and men do.
I feel this coming, and yes. I don't want to hear it.
It's
I
really
feel it
sad.
Coming.
It's really sad. And so the man will negotiate his first salary, and it usually makes about a $7,000 difference. And you think, okay, well, that's no big deal. But when you compound that over successive raises and promotions throughout the lifetime of the person, of the two people, in the end, it makes $1 million difference. Mm. $1 million over a lifetime, women leave on the table because they didn't negotiate the first salary. They don't negotiate the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And that's the massive difference that it makes. Mm-hmm. And so what you're doing when you say that's a meritocracy is you're saying that the skill that we care about most is negotiating and asking for more and pushing back and self-promoting. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, is your best finance executive the one that asks for money? Maybe. Maybe in sales, that's an important thing. So maybe your best sales executive would overemphasize for that skill.
Sure.
But all the way through the pipeline, that one little skill difference may or may not actually reflect an actual skill that you care about, but it's mm-hmm. the one that you're promoting based upon. So self-promotion and asking for money are two things that right there, you know, women and men have traditionally not been good at, or at the same at, and mm-hmm. so that has made a big massive difference. Is that a meritocracy? You know, that's a question for your organization.
That's really interesting. I did a talk recently, and it's called Successful Career Conversations. And we talk about salary negotiation, we talk about effective feedback, but I polled the group and I said, you know, raise of hands, how many of you have negotiated a salary before I started to talk about that topic? And someone audibly said to the group, I've never had the guts. And, you know, it's something that we think of as something that takes guts, not a normal part of the negotiation process, not a natural thing as part of vetting a company. You learn about the company, you decide if you want the job. Part of deciding is not just, I want to be wanted and you want me, so I take the job. It's a conversation. And I think that so many people, someone actually came up to me after and said that it was interesting that I talked about salary negotiation as a conversation, because he'd always felt like it was an adversarial relationship.
Right.
Like now it's a me against you. And that's something that takes guts to get in a fight with someone, if
right.
that's how you're thinking about it. But it's a little bit about changing our perspective and saying, it's okay. If someone doesn't say best and final, I'm going to assume that is not your best and final offer. And we're going to have a conversation. But it takes a while to get there and feel comfortable with it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And you know, there's a lot out there about win-win negotiations, mm-hmm. you know, and so part of this is reframing in our own minds what is the negotiation? What are we getting into? Because it's actually not in the company's best interest for you to be underpaid and under market, because now you are vulnerable to the next person who comes along and decides to pick you off. you're also setting up an unsustainable business model for the company, because if they can get if they have to replace you when you leave with two people to do the job, and I hear this all the time, a mm-hmm. woman leads a job and they hire two people to replace her, and that's only because she somehow got to this place where she hadn't asked for money and everyone else around her had. Now the position is worth so much more. Mm-hmm. The company now has to hire two people. I mean, that's not a great place. That's an unsustainable situation to have set up. So we do have to reframe in our minds that it's a win-win. But I'll talk more about that when we get to your questions about unconscious bias.
Okay, perfect. So you mentioned asking a company if they have a proactive program to bring women into leadership or for mentoring. So let's actually start with the mentoring process or a proactive program. What does that look like when you see a company with a proactive program or a really good mentoring program? So if they say, yes, we have this thing, now how do we evaluate that it's a real thing and might be good for us?
Right. Well, I think that, again, it's incumbent upon you, the candidate, to do your homework. So mm-hmm. personally, I would say, who have you had successfully go through the program, and can I talk to them? And that's, yeah. That's proof behind the pudding. If you have somebody who has successfully worked their way through the mentoring / sponsorship program and it has seen a successful result, you're going to be able to find out very quickly if they were devoted to the program and committed to its success or whether, again, they were box checking. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much just having the program, too. It is how the program is managed and how it's measured and whether or not they're seeing an ROI. And so I'll give you an example. My husband worked for a company where, and because he's very supportive of me and what I do, because he really doesn't want to end up in a book, mm-hmm. He signed up to be one of those mentors that helped young women move up through the organization. And he's a senior leader, and so they assigned him a woman to work with. Mm-hmm. And she showed up to the meeting and had no idea what to do with that time with him, didn't have prepared questions, didn't, know to ask him about the role and what he could do to help her, didn't have an ask, mm-hmm. really, didn't mm-hmm. have, and then didn't have a way of following up or anything. She was sort of just checking the box herself. Mm-hmm. And he was furious because he said, you have had an hour with a senior leader at this company and you haven't known the first thing what to do with that time. And now it's a waste of my time because what I want to do is help you move through this organization and create a new leader. But I don't see that because I'm seeing someone they tell me is wonderful who came in here and wasted an hour of my time. So I think it's really important to follow through with, it's one thing to set up a shell and say, okay, you're going to mentor this person, you're going to mentor. It's another thing to have primed that person to know what to ask for and to know how to conduct themselves in a meeting with a senior leader and to figure out how to best utilize that time and to come away with an ask. So it's bigger. Again, this is just an example on one level, but you can really tell if somebody's committed to something based on how much investment and how much real investment they're going to make in it. I will say that if someone goes so far as to have a mentorship program, they're probably a lot further ahead than most organizations, because most organizations' women's program is an affinity group that's mm-hmm. underfunded that basically has a once a year or a once a quarter, rah, 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 bring in some rock star, amazing woman who has a great resume to mm-hmm. get everybody wound up, and then they go away and do nothing else for six more months. Mm-hmm. And that's actually why I got involved in this work, because, and why we interviewed the women we did for our book, because we interviewed 118 college-educated women with the belief that if they went to college, that they wanted to have a career in some form. And that, and we asked them about work and life because we were really there to understand work and life. That was our initial premise going in, is how do they balance work and life? And we did it because of this rock star woman phenomena. Like, they'd parade in front of us these women that we're supposed to be like. And most of us look at, Sheryl Sandberg's a great example. Mm-hmm. I read her book, and, while it's exciting and I got that immediate rah-rah, you lean in, I need to focus more on my career. My second impulse is, but I'm not her. She's amazing, mm-hmm. And she's had an incredible background. But it's deflating to most regular women because we're not them. Mm-hmm. That's obviously, we need to reframe that, and that's part of our work. But that is the initial response. So you actually don't achieve a lot by having these rah-rah sessions because there's no follow-through. There's no way to connect Sheryl Sandberg and her amazingness with what I'm going to do tomorrow, you know, with my children or with my household, or how I'm going to manage getting to work and getting it all done. Mm-hmm. So that's why we interviewed the women that we did. And what we find also, women do need to hear what other women have done. And so we really focused in the book on sharing stories and sharing anecdotes, little things that worked. And in compilation, we got a lot of information about big things that you can do, mm-hmm. but all in little sort of anecdotes and little stories.
Could you share with us one of your favorite anecdotes or stories from the book?
Well, okay. So one of the things that we heard from a lot of the women who felt that they had been really successful with being able to get a lot done was the women who were delegating. And so delegating is a big, important step for women who have busy lives and careers. And there was one, so giving each other permission to delegate stuff is really, really important, we found. And one of the women said that she delegates everything in her household except sex with her husband. Huh. So it's on the table if it's anything else, mm-hmm. which I thought was really great. And so, you know, we heard, and this is the thing too, when women start to give themselves permission to delegate some of their tasks, we find some really amazing support industries can pop up around them. And so I myself am tough, you know, a tough one at this, at being able to let stuff go and let other people do things for me. But it's really addictive. And I've recently hired a driver to drive my kids around because I realized I'm not adding value when they're sitting in the car texting while I'm driving them to soccer, right? So I've hired a driver. I've got that Blue Apron, you know, service that delivers groceries ready to make, and you know, we can assemble them ourselves. But because I hate cooking dinner, and it's the worst part of the day for me, because you know, I'm in the flow work wise. The kids all need to be somewhere in a half an hour, and I can't stand opening the fridge and staring at a fridge and thinking, what on earth am I going to feed these kids? But I'm super picky about what they eat, of course, because I have very standards. So we've relied on services like Blue Apron. But these things can start to pop up now when we give ourselves permission that we don't have to be the ones that make the dinner, and we don't have to be the ones that drive the kids everywhere, that that this is something we can delegate. And I'll tell you another story about my husband, because one of the lessons I learned and why guys are so good at this is that when I give my husband a task to do, 5 seconds later, I see one of the kids doing it, or he's paid someone else to do it. And I think, you know, and it's really interesting. At first, it used to madden me because I thought, no, I want to see you take that trash out.
I gave you this assignment.
I gave it to you. You need to do it. But what I've learned from it is he really has learned to recognize where his time and energy are of value and what he shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a microcosm of what happens in the workplace too, because the women will spend their time box checking, focused on the detail, getting that email perfect, making sure that every little box is checked. And the men are not so focused on spending their time and energy on that. And they're much more willing and able to delegate that stuff, usually to the women.
Oftentimes.
And we go, oh, yeah, we'll tidy up the PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. We'll run those reports. We'll do detail. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that because we don't always want to step up to the more strategic stuff. So,
yeah, and it's those little things are easy, right? Like, oh, it'll just take a moment.
Yes.
It'll just be
exactly.
It'll be
and we
quick,
feel good
easy.
Because we checked a box.
Absolutely.
So let me tell you what this comes back to, because we're already jumping sort of into some of the tactics. But I want to go back, because behaviorally, what we really learned in the book was something absolutely crucial to this whole story. And that is that women have unconsciously, we call it unconscious bias, women have bought into a set of rules about being an ideal woman that is career limiting. What I mean by that is women, and we saw this over and over in the research, that women have bought into, we have to do it all.
Right.
We have to look good, and we have to be nice.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the behaviors under that is this box checking stuff, doing it all. We believe that we are the primary parent, and more than that, that parenting is our primary role, and that we get to have a career after job number one's done. Or we have to give up career entirely so that we, because of our role as parenting. And it's unconscious. You wouldn't hear a woman say this out loud, but it was all the behaviors and the language in everything. When you start to recognize this bias and this assumption that we've all made, you recognize it in the media, in magazines, in television commercials, model families on TV, Modern Family, they had a big thing about whether, you know, Claire could go back to work and what was the struggle related to that. All because parenting was her primary job, that was number one. Mm-hmm. And that the career part was the secondary fun thing. So can you imagine telling our children, our daughters this? Yes, I could tell my daughter, you get to be a rocket scientist, but ... Mm-hmm. And yet that is what we are subliminally telling them every single day. And here's how companies reinforce that. The daycare we're a good place for women to work because we have daycare subsidized. We're a good place for women to work because we have flexible time arrangements. Why do women need flexible time arrangements? Well, because primary job, number one, right? ... I mean, think about how many times we are hit with that message. It's never aimed at dad. It's never, and then you think about the women who don't have children. Well, their excuse to take time off work is not as valid because they're not, you know, leaving to go take their kids somewhere. They're leaving because they want to selfishly mm-hmm. go run a marathon or go do something for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the second part of this whole, you know, we need to do it all. We need to do it all as long as it's for someone else. But anything I do for me is selfish. And that's the worst word you can call a woman is selfish, mm-hmm. right? So then we look at the look good. How many women you know have this perfectionism mentality? We're fed this from early, early age. We have a ticker tape in our heads that says, I need to be perfect. I need to be perfect. I need to be perfect. Right?
And then here we are in Los Angeles.
Right.
I feel a lot better when I go to Massachusetts. I want to look good all the time, but Los Angeles is a whole
Yeah, it's a whole other level of it, right? Yeah, it's how we get up in the morning and spend something like three times as much time getting ready as men do. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the time and money investment in looking good. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. But it's more than that. It's that we want to do safe jobs. We don't want to take risks because the other half of we need to be perfect is we're not really good enough. And we all know it. And it's, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm an imposter. I don't really deserve the job. Some of the data. So women, when they apply for a job, don't feel comfortable until they have 100% of the requirements. They want to see every single box. And if there's one not on there, they won't apply for the job. Mm-hmm. For men, it's 60%. Mm-hmm. Now think of that in a microcosm. Think about your candidate pool. And when you say, I can't find any women, your candidates, all the men have 60% of the requirements and they're asking, and the women have 100% and there are fewer of them, mm-hmm. you know? I see this, so I'm a youth soccer coach and I also train and recruit other youth soccer coaches in my spare time. And one of the things I notice when I go out on the soccer field and ask parents, hey, will you step up and coach, is the men put up their hands. They step forward and they go, yeah, whatever, there's a ball, there's a field. How hard can it be? Mm-hmm. The women physically take a step back. Oh, hey, no, I don't know anything about soccer. I never played soccer. I've never been trained to be a soccer coach. Ooh, no, I can't mm-hmm. do that. And even though I offer training and I tell them, often the best soccer coaches don't know anything about soccer because they're in it for the kids. The women still have to, when I go up and ask them directly and say, would you be a soccer coach? I think you'd be really good at it. They go, oh, really? Because I picked them, right?
Wow,
so we start this in middle school. Mm-hmm. We start it with the dance. Mm-hmm. And we still have the boys pick the girls. Mm-hmm. And the girls have to be pretty enough for the boys to pick us, right? We have to do a good enough job for the boys to pick us, right? And we're still doing it. We're waiting for the organization to pick us mm-hmm. to come do the job instead of putting ourselves forward. And if we ever make a mistake, I see this also on the soccer field, little boys will go out and try the latest messy move and they'll screw up and they'll laugh at themselves and they'll, you know, josh each other on the shoulder and say, ah, ha, ha, you screwed that up, and they keep going. Girls will go out very carefully and try to move that ball very carefully and perfectly. And they'll ask, coach, how do I hold my foot on the ball? I have to be very precise in how I tell a girl how to learn. She's not going to intuit it, and she's not going to try it and goof around and make mistakes. She wants it to be perfect. And if she goes out on the field and she makes a mistake, and if a coach or a parent yells, "Oh my gosh, you got to get those," or reinforces the error, she will do everything she can to not touch the soccer ball for the rest of the game. She will run around the field and hide to stay away from the ball because she doesn't want to make a mistake. And that hinders our learning, right? We learn when we make mistakes. Right. And yet we have trained women to not make mistakes, mm-hmm. right? Because of this whole perfectionism thing. So, and I'm sure this resonates with a lot of people because I know for me it's the one I struggle with the most. And then the last one, the be nice. So here's where that shows up. It shows up when we think, I'm going to keep my head down and wait for someone to come and tell me that it's time for a reward of some kind. They'll notice me if I just do the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. And we have this all over the place. In fact, the president of Microsoft said it one day out loud. He got a lot of heat for it, but he said, oh, women just need to, it's just karma. Karma will come. If you put in good karma, you will be recognized. It will come back to you. And of course, that's not what the data says. It's absolute crap. But that's what we're told early on. The other thing we're told is that we're not really entitled to rewards, right? Like, it's selfish and it's awful if a woman wants money and power. Those are the ugly things. We're supposed to be the nonprofit ones. We're supposed mm-hmm. to do it for the good of the company and the good of the family and the good of the society, right? Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be these noble, above material things, people, and not feel good about the fact that we're getting rewarded. And if we do the right things, someone else is going to take care of us, right? Because that's the other half of we'll take care of the family if someone takes care of us. Mm-hmm. But we know that doesn't exist anymore. So when we found that there was this bias underneath everything, I mean, imagine I'm trying to, if I'm an organization and I'm trying to train my women to negotiate more, but they've got this bias underneath that says, we don't even deserve to be here at the table. This is our second job. It's only our fun job. You know, our real job is at home. Think about how laden, how anviled mm-hmm. their world is, like how they're held back by the bias before they get to the table. So really, and we've heard about the bias that other people have about women, but what I'm talking about is, what about the bias every woman has about herself? That right. she's using to hold herself back, that we can't get to teach her the skill because there's a physical barrier now in her mm-hmm. mind that's going to keep her from coming to the table. And when we reinforce that by saying things like, oh, I don't know how you do it all. Mm-hmm. I laugh. When male colleagues ask me, I don't know how you do it all. I mean, you're a mom of three. You do all this soccer stuff. You work. You know, how do you do it all? I say, I don't know. Same way you do. How do you do it all? And they go, oh, well, it's different for me. I'm like, mm-hmm. really? Why? Mm-hmm. Why is it different? That's in your own mind. So essentially what we teach women to do is to find those assumptions, recognize that they're there, pick them up, look at them from all angles, and decide for themselves, do I agree? Mm-hmm. And if you've decided you agree, great. You get to put it back down and go on with your day, and you have no conflict, right? Because you've now chosen consciously. But if you don't agree, if you say, wow, no, this isn't how I want to live. I don't agree that I'm not entitled to rewards or, you know, that I'm the primary parent. Now you get to reframe. Mm-hmm. Now you get to rewrite the rule. You get to throw it out and say, I don't agree. I get to rewrite. And we call it the reframe. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the family side, what if instead of mom is the primary parent, mom's primary job is the family and taking care of everyone, and the corollary to that is dad is responsible to be the provider mm-hmm. and is the only one responsible to earn a living.
Right.
What if we're both responsible for home and family and for earning a living, both of us? Now the possibilities open up. And it's funny, my husband and I, as we go on this journey together, have had many opportunities to practice this. And one recently, I was getting ready to go away on a business trip, and I was preparing, you know, all the childcare and backup plan for where everybody had to be all week. And then he was going on a business trip, and I was running around preparing all the backup plan for mm-hmm. where everybody had to be. And then it was like, well, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. We're both traveling. Why don't, when I travel, I make the backup arrangements? And when you travel, you make the backup arrangements because you're the one that needs to cover your own stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, I agree. That's a great idea. But gosh, you have all the contacts. You're the one who's built the village. I'm like, yeah, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So now we both have to build a village. That's what we do. But also the pressure that it takes off him to know that I am also responsible for earning a living in our family mm-hmm. means that he doesn't have that immense pressure that he can never lose a job or that he can't explore something career-wise that he might want to explore. So it's one of these things that once you start practicing the reframe, you open up a massive new opportunity for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with, you know, on the perfectionism side. And this is one that, you know, because it's my struggle, I really have embraced and have to, you know, have to practice quite a lot. But what if instead of being perfect, we get to be good enough for where we are right now? Mm-hmm. And I had a boss once tell me when I first was promoted to vice president, and I was beating myself up all the time, considering myself an imposter. And I know a lot of women feel like they're imposters in their own role, right? Like we didn't really, we somehow snookered them to get here, and now we can't make any mistakes, and we have to be perfect.
Waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right.
When will they find out?
When will they find out that they made a mistake, mm-hmm. you know, that I only had 99% of the requirements and not 100, right? I duped them somehow. And I remember feeling that way, of course. And then I was so afraid of making a mistake, and I would, you know, beat myself up for not being as great as like some guy three levels ahead of me in the food chain. And my boss said, "Why are you doing that to yourself?" And I said, "Well, because I'm not as good as so-and-so." And he says, "Yeah, but so-and-so's been in that job for like 20 years mm-hmm. and has this background." He goes, "For a junior vice president, you're doing great." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and you're, by the way, allowed to be a junior vice president. Junior vice presidents make mistakes at vice presiding. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And it was just such an eye-opener that he gave me permission to give myself the space to learn and to feel pretty good about where I come from. And mm-hmm. he kept saying, "You've done an awesome job. You're 30 years old. You're a vice president in this company." Mm-hmm. Like, you got to feel pretty good about that and mm-hmm. use that as your starting point. And can you imagine if we all gave ourselves a lab to be able to make mistakes, you know, and learn from those mistakes, because that's, by the way, how you learn, and create that environment at you know, in your workplace. We would be so much more successful and so much less afraid that we're going to constantly be turfed out. You know, let's face it, it takes a lot to get somebody out of an organization who isn't effective. And most of us who are worried about it and conscientious about it are far more effective than most other people, you know. We also think we have to be the best or we're the worst. It's catastrophic.
Right.
And I saw this. So I was learning to be a soccer coach, and I'm at a pretty advanced level now in soccer coaching. But when I was first coming up through the ranks, I went to this training one day. I had booked the weekend to go to a training, and I walked in, and they gave us, the first thing they did was they passed out and gave us an exam from the previous level. It was the exact same exam that I had taken like a year ago in the previous level. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking around the room. I'm already intimidated because I'm literally the only woman in the room. Everybody else in there is like a soccer player, like in my mind, a professional soccer player, right? Like they're all amazing, mm-hmm. right? And I'm already feeling so intimidated and so much like an imposter. Like, why do I think I can coach at this level and everything? And I'm looking around the room feeling intimidated. So I take this test, and as I'm taking the test, like it's been a year, so I've forgotten some stuff, right? Sure. And I'm not really the book smart kind of memorize the soccer terms kind of person. So I'm flipping through, and there are full pages that I'm leaving empty. So of course I panic, and I go to the restroom, and I'm in there going, "Oh my gosh, I should leave, I have to leave, I'm not here, why did I even do this?" And I had to talk myself into, you know, you paid for the weekend, you've got the time off, it's time, let's just do it and see what happens. And, you know, maybe I won't be the best one, but I'm probably, even if I'm the worst, maybe I can hang on and not fail, you mm-hmm. know, at least pass the course. And I had to do this self-talk that reframed it, that said, it's okay to not be the best one. Mm-hmm. I could just be an okay coach. I don't have to be the best. So somehow I get myself back into that room, and they decide to take up the test, and they go around the room and ask people the first question. Anybody know the first question? And no one says a word. I look around. I'm like, oh. So I put up my little hand, and I'm like, I think I might know that one, with this little teeny tiny meek voice, right? And it turns out I did. And then we would go around, and we're checking the rest of them. And what I realized is, oh my gosh, they don't know this either. Right. Not only am I not the worst one here, I'm actually kind of in the middle. This is kind of okay, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought, this is what women do. This is what we do to ourselves. And we keep ourselves away from the table. We keep ourselves from expressing our ideas because of this level of intimidation that's crazy. It's all in our own minds. This is all what we're doing to ourselves. So it is my passion to work with women and get us to reframe that ticker tape so that we can go into the situation and recognize that we deserve to be here. We don't have to be the best. We're so school focused, right? Mm-hmm. Like we did so well in school, right? You know, and in school, the rules were really simple. You just, you know, you memorize the stuff, you regurgitate it back in a test, you get an A, someone else gives you the A, you know, it's like you get picked, you know, for things. And so we try to, you know, manage our careers and the work environment the same way. And we think, you know, well, we need to get an A, otherwise, you know, the world's going to end. And it's like, we really don't, you know, and we don't have to get an A on everything at the same time. You know, a big part of reframing perfectionism is understanding when it's important to knock it out of the park. You know, if you're an accountant and it's the end, or you're in accounting and it's the end of quarter close, you better get the numbers right.
Right.
But the email that you type up that we, by the way, as women, obsess over not making a mistake on, that part doesn't need to be perfect.
Right.
You know, my business partner got this email from someone one day, or got a response to an email she'd sent that said, did you know that you made a typo in the email and everything? And then, you know, we almost got sucked down into, oh my gosh, how could we send out an email that had a typo?
Should we send another email?
Should we send another one to explain that that was not, you know. But I mean, we're laughing, but women do this all the time.
Yes.
All the time, right?
It's only funny on the radio. It's never funny when I'm sitting in front of my computer.
That's exactly
not a joke.
But the reality is that there are things that we could do well enough all day long that would free up our time and energy to do the things that are the most important to knock those at the park. You know, I'm thinking of another example of that movie, I Don't Know How She Does It, ironically it's called, where it's the opening scene and she's running, she's at her big busy career, and then she has to run to the school potluck, and she goes to the store and she buys a pie and she pulls the wrapper off it, and she swings by home and she grabs a plate from home and she slips the pie into the plate and runs into the school and throws it down on the potluck table. Like, you know, in addition, she pretends it's her homemade pie because she had to be perfect at that, you know, at that some stupid thing at school. And I will tell you, the number of stupid made-up things that schools do now, it's 100 years away from what we were, when we were growing up, what our moms were expected to do. And even more than in the 50s, you know, a staggering stat, in the 50s, since the 50s, men are doing twice as much housework as what, you know, men did in the 50s, and women are doing three times as much. And it's unbelievable when you think about, and we're also working full-time, right? So, and think about what our daughters are seeing.
Well, the housework particularly strikes a chord for me. When I'm thinking about reframing, I don't know that I'm using the word reframing. I am a little bit because I'm a trained coach. So those are terms that go through my mind. But what I'm thinking to myself is be nicer to yourself. Be nicer to yourself. And when I read your white paper, you know, when we first met a few months ago, and I make it a practice to read it kind of regularly. And it's a little synopsis of the book, but it tells me, it's a reminder of tackling those unconscious biases. And that was something that actually inspired me. I hired someone to help clean my house. And she comes once every 3 weeks, and she is so much, you talk about knocking it out of the park, she knocks it out of the park.
Right.
I'm not so freaking great at cleaning my house. And if we're having guests over, it might mean my husband and I spent an entire Saturday making everything perfect in a way that she does in 3 hours every 3 weeks. And it just gave me such perspective of like, I have people tell me often, like, oh, if I worked from home or if I had my own business, my house would be spotless. And that rings in my head. Because what those people are saying is they would procrastinate by by cleaning their homes. And so it somehow makes me feel guilty that really all of my waking hours are spent either, you know, with my husband, or I'm working on or on my business, or with clients. So it's, you know, I joke.
And why would you feel guilty about that, right?
Right, but it's the thing that plays in my head. And it is so liberating, and I feel so good that I have asked for help in this way.
Yeah.
And it really is such a tremendous load off of my shoulders. But
well, you know, it's funny
that
it is amazing what you do to yourself. And here's another one, though, the other side of that. So it's amazing that here we are in 2016 and we're giving, you know, we gave you permission to clean your house. You know, it's right. That's one of the earliest you know, things that women are the easiest on the ladder of things that women will delegate is mm-hmm. is the clean house. And yet there are still women who don't feel comfortable with it. And mm-hmm. There was one woman we interviewed who talked about, well, I can't let someone else clean my house because my stove was $10,000 and the housekeepers come in and they don't know what they're doing and they scratch my stove, you know. And I'm like, do you know how many stoves can you pay for in a lifetime of earnings? You know, and really your stove, like your stove, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the mentality is I can't delegate because they're not going to do it as well as I can. And we see this in the workplace too. Well, I can't give it to my team because they're not going to produce it as well. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a reflection on mm-hmm. me. And mm-hmm. so I need to do it. And so what a lot of women do is they keep the members of their team at a really low level. Mm-hmm. And then they have to add more and more because, you know, to get the work done. And then they take on a huge amount and they keep themselves like indispensable.
Right.
And it really, it's this insecurity about delegating and letting somebody else do it when they're not the expert, when they're not better at it than mm-hmm. us. But the reality is that is still good enough. You know, mm-hmm. you are empowering and you are creating, you are a multiplier effect when you get other people on your team to do the work, even if it's not as great as you did it. And the second piece of it is, I think a lot of women, when they start experimenting with delegating, if they do finally give themselves permission to mm-hmm. get help and to delegate, is that they think it means give it to someone and turn around and walk away. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. It's a management process. And at first, it can take almost as much time as doing the task yourself to actually show someone how to do it well mm-hmm. and to stay with them and manage them and help them through. But then in time, that actually isn't the case. And right. so I think a lot of times we have this black and white, either or kind of a mentality that says, well, I tried it once, it didn't work, or I tried it for a short time and it took too much of my energy and so mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. But the women who've actually leveraged this really, really well, the kind of the people who can do it all mm-hmm. or can have it all without doing it all, you right. know, those women, it's because they gave it the time. They invested in the management of the process and gave it the time so that those people could truly learn to do it well. Or they realized it's okay if the housekeeper doesn't do it as well as mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. I've never had a housekeeper who can clean my house the way I know I can. But it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's because I've let that go as being important. Because right now, it's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And my investment in the process, I can choose to invest more if I want it to be better. Mm-hmm. But I don't choose to. I don't choose to put my energy there because I would rather, you know, be investing in delegating even more tasks mm-hmm. that suck my time and energy away, you know. So it's a real mentality that you know that we're trying to train into women is like look for these opportunities to really free yourself mm-hmm. from the burdens of all of this baggage and guilt and nonsense mm-hmm. that are just made up rules.
Yeah.
We don't have to do it this way.
Exactly. And it's when you're saying I have to do this, I have to do this, I have a million things to do. It's stopping and saying, you know, do you?
Yeah.
How could you get this done quicker? And sometimes, I mean, I know personally for me, I am moving so fast all the time that if I just take a minute and say, wait a minute, what do I really need to do? What's the priority? It's never as overwhelming or as dreadful or, you know, as I've made it seem because I haven't taken the time to say, how can I make this easier on myself?
Yeah. And then giving yourself the compassion. So mm-hmm. what if you drop stuff? Yeah. The thing is that if you take control over your prioritization and what you want to get done, you get to choose what falls through the cracks is the right. way I look at it. Because something's going to fall through the cracks and that's okay.
Yeah.
But as long as you chose it, as long as your priorities are right. And that's a 21st century leadership skill, right? Mm-hmm. Is being able to be discerning mm-hmm. and determine. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, I don't care what your house looks like. Mm-hmm. Why should you care what your house looks like? You're an amazing person. And I would rather you invest your time and energy into your passion and your calling mm-hmm. because you do an incredible amount of work to help people. Mm-hmm. Why would your house be anywhere on that equation? Mm-hmm. Only because we've trained ourselves to believe that home is the woman's job. And mm-hmm. so if there's a hair out of place, or, you know, I laugh when daycare used to call, you know, my husband would drop the kids off at daycare. daycare, and I would pick them up. Mm-hmm. And one day it got cold, and daycare calls and says, you know, your daughter's here without a sweater, and it's really cold out. And I'm thinking, you saw him drop off. Like, why are you calling me, right? But it's because we all think that it's mom's responsibility and that she's a bad mother if there's no sweater. It's not a bad dad if there's no sweater, right?
No, it's true.
And it's ridiculous. But it's like, okay, so if it's important enough, fish one out of the lost and found and off we go, right?
Right.
Like, make her warm. I don't care if it's matching her outfit, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's so many people out there that are hearing you say that and thinking, oh my gosh, I want to say that. I want to say you know what, if she's warm, if there's a sweater in the lost and found, that's okay. And I could do this interview for 2 hours, but we are wrapping up our time together. And I just want to share that I was at a women's group not long ago, and we were talking about these unconscious biases, and we were talking about them at work. And then there was a man, and there was just a few men in the group, and a man got up, and unfortunately it was well-intentioned, but he said something very insensitive. And then someone else was able to kind of reframe it and make everyone feel better. But as we were leaving, people were saying, gosh, I wish there was someone that could help us with this. I wish there was a company that would help him understand why what he said was insensitive and how the people that were sensitive could tune into that. And I was like throwing your email at everyone. I was like, give me your card. I'll send you Kelly's white paper. So, I mean, I can't tell you how important the work you've done has been in my life, and just helping me tune into where I can be a little kinder to myself and see those unconscious biases. And I know that the work you do is so very important. I mentioned Kelly's white paper. You can check it out at orangegroveconsulting.com. We'll definitely pop her website into the archives of the show. So you can look at her white paper there and get a little more information on the book. And you can also talk with Kelly if you want to send her an email, or you think that your company or you personally could use some help. Please take advantage of this amazing resource. And I'll share her email. So it's just Kelly@orangegroveconsulting.com. So once again, thank you, my friend, for being here. We greatly appreciate it and learned so much.
Thank you for having me.
Have a great day.